On To the Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To the Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To the Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
We had 5 Humvees, 23 Marines, packed to the teeth, machine guns, grenades, every weapon you can imagine, and the whole power and might of the United States military behind us. And we were all brought to a screeching halt by this benign animal, this ass of an animal that made us all look like asses, really.
That's Maximilian Uriarte, an artist and a storyteller and a Marine. He met the donkey he's referring to during a tour of duty in Iraq. He started a comic strip when he was on active duty in the Marine Corps called Terminal Lance, and that comic strip was the basis for a graphic novel called The White Donkey. It's just been published by Little Brown, but The White Donkey started out as a Kickstarter project. It's the first graphic novel about the Iraq War written and illustrated by a veteran, and Max is here now. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. So talk about this comic strip that you started, Terminal Lance, and how it came to be.
So I was in the Marine Corps from 2006 to 2010, and I had always been an artist my whole life, and I looked at the landscape of things that were sort of available for Marines to read in terms of like satire and humor, and there wasn't really anything. There was one comic strip that I can think of called Semper Tunes by Gunny Charles Wolfe, and that was pretty much it, but I felt like it didn't really accurately reflect the Marine Corps that I had sort of experienced over the last 4 years in the wartime environment from a junior enlisted, really low ranking standpoint. So I saw an opening and I took it, and I Googled my way through building a website, and I just started doing Terminal Lance as a 3-panel comic strip for the Marine Corps, and I put it online, and it started very small and underground, and eventually kind of snowballed into what it is today.
What does it mean, Terminal Lance?
Yeah, I think I get asked that question the most. Terminal Lance is a term in the Marine Corps that describes someone that, I don't want to curse on the radio, but doesn't care or doesn't give a insert, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. Because usually, ideally, in a Marine Corps scenario where you serve 4 years, you would end at the rank of corporal, which is the rank above Lance Corporal. But if you are like me, and maybe for whatever reason, you just never picked up that rank of corporal. Being terminal in the military is getting out. So that means you're on your way out. So a terminal lance then is somebody who's getting out of the military as a lance corporal, which is usually not considered a good thing.
And you didn't want a career in the military?
No, not at all.
No, you say that with such assurance.
Oh, yeah.
Did you not enjoy your time in the military?
You know, like, I would say I miss the Marines a lot more than I miss the Marine Corps. I mean, you know, I enjoyed my experiences. I had a lot of experiences that I cherish and I think helped make me a better person. But I had never intended on making the Marine Corps, the military, a career. Like from the day I entered the Marine Corps and I stood on those yellow footprints, I was counting down the days till I was getting out of the Marine Corps.
Why did you join in the first place?
You know, that's a weird question for me because I feel like most people answer it with assurance of patriotism and calling and all of that. And for me, I really did it on a whim. And I was not the kind of person that would join the military. I didn't play football in high school. I wasn't particularly athletic or anything. But I was an artist, and I've been an artist my whole life. And I was writing and drawing serious stories, and I felt like I needed to experience something in the world that was terrible to give what I was doing, I guess, more weight or more meaning. And so I looked at what was going on and I was like, oh, the war in Iraq's going on right now. What's the quickest way I can get to Iraq? Because that'll give me some experience to draw on in my life or something. I don't know, some stupid angsty 19-year-old solution. But
it has given you experience to draw on, literally, because you've drawn this graphic novel that is based on your experiences in Iraq?
That's very true. Yeah. So in a way, I guess I sort of got exactly what I was shooting for with this whole thing. But yeah, I mean, for me, I always felt kind of like an outsider in the Marine Corps. And I think it's that perspective from day one where I never really felt like a Marine. I never really felt like I belonged. I was able to sort of keep myself mentally on the outside too, and became more of an observer and more of a someone that was able to put something like that out there.
So the main character in your novel, The White Donkey, his name is Abe. And it sounds like from what you're telling me that there are a lot of parallels between him and you, at least when it comes to having a distant perspective on the Marine Corps and an ambivalent relationship to the Corps and and to the purpose of it.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to write a book that more accurately reflected my own experience in the Marine Corps. And I think that it's not so black and white for a lot of Marines. I think a lot of Marines just don't express that very well. But yeah, Abe is a reflection of me in a lot of ways. My middle name is Abraham, actually.
Oh, okay. So he's an atheist.
Yes.
Are you?
I do consider myself an atheist, actually. And I think that, you know, it took me a long time to be comfortable coming to terms with that, to just be able to actually say, yes, I am an atheist, like, and not feel some shame or guilt in saying that. But it actually brings me a lot of comfort now, like just knowing what I am and being comfortable with that.
So, but that's a point in the book.
Yes.
That paints him as an outsider. His best friend has a big cross tattooed on his back.
Yes. Yeah, there's a lot of the religious aspects of the book play a lot into the story from a literal and metaphorical standpoint. And I think, you know, that struggle with faith, I think, is something that everybody kind of deals with at some point, including myself. And I wanted to put that in the book on some level.
The White Donkey refers to a white donkey that Abe encounters in the middle of the book when they're on tour in Iraq, and they're in a convoy, and he sees this white donkey in the middle of the road, and it's becomes a mythical figure for him.
Yeah. So the white donkey was real. That was a real experience that I had. It pretty much happens exactly like it happens in the book. They run into a donkey during a mounted patrol in Iraq, and it stops their entire convoy. And I guess what I felt was so profound about that moment for me in real life was just this realization that, you know, we had 5 Humvees, 23 Marines, packed to the teeth with machine guns, grenades, every weapon you can imagine, and the whole power and might of the United States military behind us. And we were all brought to a screeching halt by this benign animal, this ass of an animal that made us all look like asses, really.
But also the donkey symbolizing the old way of life in the Middle East.
Well, so what I always like to ask people when they read the book is, what do you think the donkey represents in the book? And I find that when most people describe the book to me or they talk about the book, they actually never mention the donkey, which I think is sort of really interesting because it's on the title of the book. And the way I like to describe it is, it is actually the most and least important part of the book, because you could read the whole book and not read anything into the donkey and it would still all make sense. But the donkey is also the key to the kind of metaphorical story that's going on in the book as well.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Maximilian Uriarte. He is the author of a new graphic novel. It's called The White Donkey. In your novel, you follow Abe, who's the lead character, and he undergoes a very traumatic event, and it changes him forever.
Yes.
And he's driving a tank. Is it an MRAP?
It's an MRAP.
Uh-huh.
It's an acronym for mine-resistant, ambush-protected vehicle.
But not so resistant because it goes over an IED.
Yeah, so that's the thing with MRAPs is it actually functioned exactly like it was supposed to. The explosion didn't breach the hull, which is the bottom of the MRAP, but it flipped the MRAP. And so whoever's in the turret ends up being in the most danger. In this case, Garcia.
His best friend.
His best friend in the story was in the turret of the MRAP and actually gets caught underneath it as it flips over. And that's sort of how Garcia meets his fate.
Did that ever happen to you?
No, that event didn't happen to me. Garcia is a completely fictional character. And actually, Abe and Garcia are essentially different halves of myself. You know, Abe, so I'm half Mexican and I'm half Jewish. And Abe really represents my Jewish half and Garcia really represents my Mexican half. And it's really kind of about this internal conflict almost with myself, which is kind of weird to say out loud. But
well, one side survives.
One side survives, yeah.
Barely.
Barely, yes. But I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, that's sort of like esoteric garbage. But I mean, like, I wanted to tell a story of loss, and I wanted to tell a story that Marines could relate to, because a lot of Marines do go through that, you know, traumatic event of losing someone that's very close to them in a very sudden, very real way that they can't do anything about. And I think that one of the things that kind of bothers me about movies and general media portrayal of like Marines dying in Afghanistan, or, you know, soldiers or whatever dying in Afghanistan or Iraq, is what Abe mentions in the book, actually, is that, you know, he didn't hold him in his arms. He didn't say anything to him with his dying breaths. And it's this really traumatic reality where it's like, this could happen at any moment and there's nothing you can do about it. And so it sort of sends him into this downward spiral of trying to come to terms with this really sudden, unresolved loss.
And you say at the end of the book in some notes that you did this in part to bring attention to the epidemic of military suicides.
Yeah, that is something that I wanted to really draw attention to with this book, because even back then when I started writing it in 2010, you know, military suicides were very high, and they still are very high. I mean, I've known personally four Marines that have killed themselves since I got out of the Marine Corps. And that's, you know, I'm one of many Marines. Well, you know, everybody knows someone that has killed themselves since they got out or are even still in. And if, you know, a Marine reads this book and can identify with Abe and can understand that, you know, they aren't going through this alone, that other people have these problems, I feel like that's about the best that I could ever ask for.
Did you have any feelings along those lines when you got out?
I have personally suffered from depression and anxiety and a lot of just mental anguish over various things. And, you know, my experiences in Iraq were not, you know, they were not action-packed. And I think that's something I wanted to draw attention to in the book, too, is Marines actually struggle with that idea that they should have been in this action movie while they're in Iraq. And that's something that I wanted to bring into it as well, where it's like you're trying to come to terms with the fact that you weren't kicking down doors and shooting bad guys all day, because when you come home, everybody wants to hear that story when that might just not be what it is. And I think one of the worst questions that people can ask you is, have you ever killed anybody? Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, every veteran, every Marine has faced that question before. And it's a terrible question because, you know, there's no right answer to it. And, you know, you either say yes and you're now a psychotic killer guy, or you say no. And if you say no, though, that immediately invalidates your experience to the person who asked the question, because that's all they wanted to know. And so, you know, you say no and they go, oh, well, it must not have been that bad, you know. When in reality, I mean, I was there every day and I pointed guns at people and I had to make decisions of whether or not I was going to kill them. And I'm an atheist, but I thank the good Lord every day that I made the right decision in those calls.
Not to pull the trigger.
Not to pull the trigger, because that's a harder decision to make a lot of the time.
But still traumatic, right, to be in that position.
I mean, I think it is on some level. I'm not going to sit here and say that, you know, I suffered from PTSD or anything like that. I think I was relatively okay in that regard. For me, my experience was more coming to terms with, you know, what I didn't do, what I wanted to do, and even coming to terms with this idea that it's like, you know, did I want to kill somebody? Like, would that have made me feel better? Would that have made me feel like a man in that scenario, and coming to terms with the idea that that is ridiculous. Like, that's a ridiculous thing to want to do. And, like, how awful is that to actually want that under your belt? But a lot of Marines struggle with that, including myself, because you have this expectation, you have this in your head that you're going to go there and be this action hero and do some, like, cool stuff. And it is a very, like, I think, naive and sort of disgusting way to look at the world personally.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That's Maximilian Uriarte. He's a Marine Corps veteran, and his graphic novel, The White Donkey, Terminal Lance, is the first graphic novel about the Iraq War written and illustrated by a veteran. Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you're a combat veteran, we'd like to hear from you. Have you read anything that has helped you make sense of your experience? Let us know at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the story of a Japanese-American man who was interned during World War II, then fought for the Americans in the war, where he faced the possibility of shooting at an enemy that included his brother. A Family Divided by War. That's next on Press Play.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program Morning Becomes Eclectic can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app and get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. President Obama just visited Japan. His trip included a stop in Hiroshima, the first sitting president to do so. Hiroshima and the bomb play a central role in a new biography set during World War II. It's about a typical American kid growing up in Washington State in the 1920s. He was brash and rebellious, sure of his own immortality into sports and girls and doing the opposite of what his parents wanted him to do. But Harry Fukuhara was also Japanese, which means that as he grew up, his two cultures, American and Japanese, were sometimes at odds and then literally at war with one another, World War II. Harry, an ardent defender of America, would be ripped from his life in Los Angeles and imprisoned in an internment camp by American authorities. He would be recruited as an intelligence analyst by the Army while he was interned. And he would fight for the Americans against the Japanese army, ever worried that his three brothers would meet him on the opposite side of the battlefield. Historian Pamela Rottner Sakamoto tells Harry Fukuhara's story in her new book. It's called Midnight in Broad Daylight, A Japanese-American Family Caught Between Two Worlds. Welcome.
Thank you, Madeline, for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. Take us back to the beginning and tell us about Harry's early life in Auburn, Washington. What was his family like and what did they do for a living?
Well, his family consisted of his mom and his dad, who had emigrated from Japan to the United States in the early 1900s. His dad had come over first to work on the railroads, had succeeded and become a white-collar businessman. And his mom was a picture bride. She was the product of an arranged marriage with his father through family members in both of their native Hiroshima. It was a happy marriage. And they had five children, four boys and one girl, were all born in Seattle. Then they lived in this small town outside of Seattle of Auburn. Harry led an idyllic American lifestyle, fishing and going to the movies with friends, and felt he was exactly the same as everyone else, except, of course, that his parents spoke Japanese at home and served Japanese food on their table.
And then his father dies, and it's the Great Depression, and times become pretty tough for the family. And so his mom decides to move back to Japan, and that doesn't sit well with Harry.
No. His dad dies in 1933. His mother had not been aware of his business dealings. And when she looks at the accounts or what she can make of them with Harry, it appears that they only have a few months' worth of rent left. Harry isn't even aware of how dire the situation is. And she decides that she has to take the family back. He is 13. He is an American teenager. He cannot imagine being separated from his friends, and he puts up as good as a fight as he can, but she decides they will move back, and they do in November of 1933. He is utterly unprepared.
Yeah, he's an American boy, and he's back in Hiroshima, and he doesn't even speak Japanese that well, or he doesn't write or read Japanese that well.
No, I mean, his parents had sent him to Japanese language school after his American school, and he hated it so much that he just went through the drills in a perfunctory manner, and he was a terrible student. Every single year, he was kept in the same grade, so that when he went back to Japan as a 13-year-old, he was really only in the second grade, according to his Japanese level, and that made a rough landing for him when he made his first visit to Japan in 1933.
And so several years later, he decides, enough of this. I don't like it. I want to go back to the United States. Was that really traumatic for his mom and for the family that he decided to go back?
His mom had hoped that her children would adjust to Japan in time, but her kids had a different experience. They were American, and the younger boys were able to assimilate more quickly and learn Japanese more quickly. But Harry went to a school in Hiroshima that catered to Japanese Americans, and he did learn very good Japanese, but he didn't really become part of the society.
So it sounds like a fairly typical story of an immigrant family where the American-born children, they are much more assimilated than the parents will ever be and consider themselves American. But then Pearl Harbor happens, and Harry is forced to confront the fact that, you know, his America doesn't really view him as an American.
Harry had so many friends, and so he really had a foot in two cultures. But when he returned to the U.S., it was so tough. He did not receive the welcome that he had anticipated, and he does face this very fraught period culminating with the internment.
So he was interned. And what was his reaction to being interned? I mean, here he had moved back to the United States because he loved it. He wanted to make his life in Los Angeles and, you know, quickly found that he wasn't welcome.
Right. I mean, he struggled initially. He returned to the States in 38, and that 38 to 1941 period was one uphill battle, but he was able to make a living and he could see a future. When he was interned, his future blurred. He just had no idea how long they would be imprisoned. He was young. He wasn't able to achieve his dream of a college education, which is what his father and his mother had always wanted for him. He found himself turning very bitter, and he didn't like that aspect of himself, and he was afraid that it would become permanent.
So he's in the internment camp, and it's a pretty miserable place. And he figures out, well, one way to get out of here is to volunteer with the Army because they need translators. And so what happens next? I mean, it's fairly ironic that the military seems willing to accept him in pretty sensitive military situations on the battlefield, and yet is not, the government doesn't really trust him or other Japanese Americans at home domestically because they were seen as threats.
Absolutely. I mean, it's so full of irony. He was imprisoned ultimately by the U.S. Army because they executed the internment and they resisted recruiting from the Japanese American population until the situation in the Pacific seemed so dire with Japan continuously advancing and the United States and the other allies in retreat. And so they had so few specialists in the Army who could speak or write or read Japanese, and they decided to look at their American population, which was largely incarcerated. Harry does take a test in Gila River in Arizona, the camp where he was incarcerated. He passes it with flying colors. The formerly terrible student in Auburn, Washington, has become bilingual because of those years in Hiroshima, and he enlists partly as a way to get out of camp.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Pamela Rottner Sakamoto about her new book. It's called Midnight in Broad Daylight, A Japanese American Family Caught Between Two Worlds. So we've been talking about the American world. On the other side, Harry's family, the rest of his family, is still in Hiroshima. And his younger brother, Frank, has joined the Army himself. Was there ever a fear on the part of Harry and Frank, for that matter, that the two would face each other on the battlefield?
Well, Frank and the rest of the family in Japan really lost contact with Harry and Mary as soon as Pearl Harbor occurred. His family did not know that they had been interned. So Frank, who was really Harry's inseparable baby brother, although there were thousands of miles of distance between them, Frank just hoped that Harry was okay and really had no idea. Meanwhile, Harry knew that because his brothers were of an age that they would be conscripted into the Japanese Army, he feared that they would be drafted. He was island hopping through the Southwest Pacific, and every step as he came closer to Japan, he feared, really with good reason, that he might come into conflict with one of his dear brothers.
And that he would be part of an invading army of Japan itself.
Absolutely. By summer of 1945, Harry had reached Manila, and he was looking at the slated November 1st invasion of southern Japan. And that is precisely the island of Kyushu, where his younger brother, Pierce and Frank, were located, preparing as Japanese privates for the expected American onslaught.
So before he has to face that possibility of facing his brother or brothers on the battlefield, the United States drops the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Yes, so his mom and his older brother and his aunts and his cousins and family friends were all there. His brother was very close. He was burned on his back, and in time those burns would fester and he would die. His mother was exposed to black rain. She sickened. She would lose her hair. She would have all of the symptoms, but she also eventually recovered. Another cousin was killed, only lasted a day. And there was so much fallout among so many friends and family.
Mm. And Harry made his way to Hiroshima to try to find his family. And what was his reaction when he saw what had happened?
Well, as soon as he thought about it, he thought, oh my goodness, I wonder who is in Hiroshima of my family. And he was afraid to go there because he was afraid of what he would find and that they were gone. But he went in October of 1945. And he got special permission from his commanding officer. And he braced himself. And then he found his mother and his aunt and his brothers. And he did not want to recognize that his older brother, Victor, was gravely ill. But he kept that in the back of his mind. It troubled him deeply. But he was basically overjoyed to find that they had survived and hoped that this was the beginning of a new life for all of them.
But I wonder if he felt guilty at all. I mean, obviously he wasn't involved in the actual decision to drop the bomb, but the fact that he was fighting for the Americans, did he feel culpable at all? Did he have any guilt or any survivor's guilt at all?
He did. It started setting in even in Manila as he heard the news. He felt as if he had dropped the bomb on his parents' native city. And he did believe that his family had perhaps perished and that he was responsible. And that when he landed in Japan and saw the ravages of the war, he vowed that someday, if he could, he would try to help Japan recover. And that's truly what he did. It was unconscious at first, and then it became very deliberate over time.
Mm. For the rest of his career after the war.
For almost five decades,
yeah.
Yes.
So he ended up staying in the military for the rest of his career. And still, when he just got back right after the war ended, to Los Angeles, he faced discrimination, even as a decorated war hero. What did he tell you about that?
Oh, he said it was terrible. He said unless he wore his uniform, he was the subject of slurs and dirty looks. And it was very much the same kind of situation that he had left when he was forcibly evacuated for the internment. He was unable to find a job. He was lost emotionally at wit's end, worried about his family in Japan, but he had to leave with his troops. But then, as he was troubled by what was happening in Los Angeles, he received a letter, and it signaled to him that Victor was very ill and he needed to get back to Japan, and the U.S. Army was away. They needed linguists, and they accepted him on the spot. And that was the beginning of an illustrious career during the occupation and the post-war years.
So he ended up spending a lot more time in Japan.
Right. He did go back to Japan, the very country that he had never really wanted to go to. But he was able to be really the patriarch of this divided family.
Mm. So a happy ending after all that turmoil.
It is a story of redemption. It's a story of family love across war, of great struggle, but great purpose in the end.
So if you had asked him, and I don't know if you did ask him this, but if you had, are you Japanese first or American first? What would he have said?
I did ask him, but I didn't need to, actually, because I saw his behavior over time. He would have said flat out, without hesitating, "I'm an American." He was a proud colonel in the U.S. Army and a extremely highly ranked and legendary military intelligence officer. He had no doubt where his loyalties lay, even if his native country had doubted him. But he knew that he had a facility with Japanese language and cultural understanding, and he put it to good use to become a bridge between the United States and Japan. And he was able to be highly effective because of his affinity and empathy.
Well, I want to thank you so much. It was really fascinating.
Thank you, Madeline. It's been a pleasure.
That's Pamela Rottner Sakamoto. Her new book is called Midnight in Broad Daylight, A Japanese-American Family Caught Between Two Worlds. Coming up, a celebrity photographer turns his lens on people we often don't want to look at.
Everybody has preconceived notion of what a homeless person is like. So it was more or less giving them an outlet to introduce themselves.
That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune download podcast to receive a free song of the day. Find Today's Top Tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Life on the streets is being documented in another way. Photographer Martin Scholler is best known for his celebrity portraits. His signature portraits are close-ups. He calls them hyper-detailed, where you can see every hair, every pore, and the eyes are really bright. He's taken photos of famous people such as Bill Clinton, Angelina Jolie, Robert De Niro, and his work appears in glossy magazines like Vogue and The New Yorker. His latest project is different. He's been photographing homeless people in Los Angeles and posting the images to Instagram. And he joins me now to tell us more. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Well, how did this project start?
Friends of mine or colleagues of mine have always been saying, oh, you have to post images on Instagram. That's what everybody is doing. And I've been very reluctant for years. But in the same time, I came across this great food coalition called the Greater West Hollywood Food Coalition, kind of a tongue breaker, that was started by parents of a friend of mine. And they've been feeding homeless people in Hollywood for 28 years. And I have a long history of photographing people on the street. Even when I went to photo school in Berlin, for some reason, I ended up hanging out with homeless men, with some drunkards, and photographing them sleeping in the parks. So it just felt natural to me to take some pictures of these clients of the Greater West Hollywood Food Coalition. And once I started doing some close-up portraits on the street corner, I thought, maybe this could be good for Instagram, because I never wanted to do something on Instagram just featuring my own life, what I always call my privileged, lucky, lucky existence. So that's how it came about.
So you posted them to your Instagram. Did you do it to bring awareness, more awareness to the homeless problem, or just for your own sake?
No, the idea is to. I spoke with Ted and Penny, the founders of this coalition, and the idea was, you know, to give homeless people living on the street a face and a voice. Everybody passes by, people on the street. Everybody has preconceived notion of what a homeless person is like, and you know, sometimes those notions might be right, and other times they might not be. So it was more or less giving them an outlet to introduce themselves.
And how do you shoot the photos?
I still photograph them on film. I've been doing these close-up portraits for 20 years now, and I haven't changed anything about them. I photograph everybody in the same style, with the same lights, with the same camera, with the same lens, with the same film. So there's this a great component of consistency. This very democratic approach of photographing the president the same style as homeless people.
And so with either one, is there hair and makeup or any retouching or anything?
Photographing famous people, you know, you don't get around the makeup artists that come with the territory. But on the street, obviously, there's no hair and makeup person. It's just everybody's being photographed the way they show up.
Yeah. And you photograph them dead on, looking straight at the camera.
I think it's the most intimate portrait if somebody looks in the camera. You know, if somebody faces a photographer and there's this dialogue between the camera and the person being photographed, I think it's the most intense picture, you know, having somebody look at you.
And none of these, I'm just scrolling through them now, none of them are smiling.
I think people don't walk around the street smiling, so an honest portrait is always the one. I mean, not necessarily an honest portrait. I think somebody smiling can just be as honest of a portrait as a non-smiling picture. I just always feel that when people are more relaxed, kind of you capture an in-between moment when people are not even thinking about their expression too much, just feels more intimate and more honest in a way.
Yeah. And I also noticed that several of the subjects are transgender. Is that something that you encountered?
Yeah, this food coalition has been chased all over the place in Hollywood, and they ended up now on a street corner that's very close to Santa Monica Boulevard. Santa Monica Boulevard has a long tradition of prostitution, mostly transgender prostitution, at least in that area where I am photographing. So there's a lot of homeless transgender prostitutes that I photographed, and I spent actually some time with them after I photographed them to see what their life is about a little bit. A lot of drugs, obviously, a lot of crystal meth addiction. And yeah, it just comes with that area that I'm photographing in. If you went to downtown Los Angeles, it would be a completely different scene. But then again, you know, not everybody living on the street is a drug addict. Many of them I photographed just people that lost their homes because they couldn't pay the rent and they didn't have a family to call upon when things got rough.
Yeah. So you have a little back and forth with almost every photo, a little interview.
Yeah, every photograph comes with a short, quick interview. I just taped my phone to one of my lights and asked them questions while I was photographing them, which I always do anyways. And then I transcribed those interviews and picked a couple of highlights that I thought were descriptive of this person and posted them on Instagram.
What's one of the more surprising interviews that you've had?
Oh, God, there's so many, you know. It's terrible. I think the one that stands out the most maybe to me are two. One is Kemi. She's, I think she just turned 19, and she's been homeless since she's 14, ran away from a group home and never been addicted to drugs and making it on the streets. But the most intriguing is probably Titi is her street name. And she was, it's a long story. She was put into prostitution by her uncle at age 9, and her mom is a complete drunk and didn't believe her. Her dad wasn't around. And yeah, now she is married to a woman and is kind of the ringleader of this street family that consists of maybe 15 to 20 people. And she quit drugs at age 15 after being a crystal meth addict for 6 years. And if everybody in her street family, nobody's allowed to do any drugs. And she kicks people out. She's this little girl, pretty much. Huh. And she kicks anybody out who she catches with drugs out of her street family. And they all look out for each other. And they call each other brother and sister. And they adopt each other. So they have really kind of like a family setting.
Yeah. And she's the head of it at age 19.
Yeah, she's a tough cookie. And everybody looks up to her. And she, you know, she is in charge and makes the decisions. And an ex-Marine is in charge of security, who stays up at night, makes sure nobody gets robbed. So it's these dynamics that exist on the street it's oftentimes very sad, but also very interesting.
What is the response when you approach people on the street to photograph them?
Well, I'm basically benefiting greatly from this food coalition, from Ted and Penny, who who've been doing this for 28 years, and some of their clients have been coming for 12, 15 years. So there is this trust that I ride on that they have towards everything that's associated with this coalition. They've been feeding, they feed people every night of the week, 365 days a year. Every night at 6:30, you go to the street corner and there's warm food waiting for you. And basically, I set up my portable studio right next to them or down the street from them. So they just point people in my direction and say, hey, do you want to get paid $20? Do you mind being on Instagram? Answer a couple of questions. And then the people that are interested walk a couple of steps and sit down for me.
And in terms of the dynamic of shooting a homeless person versus shooting a famous person, is it easier to shoot the homeless person?
Yeah, it's definitely easier to photograph them in a sense that they don't have so much of a practiced facial expression. You photograph them sometimes. I shoot 60, 70 rolls of an actor, and I think, oh, my God, I got some great intimate feeling pictures. And in the end, it feels it was all just, you know, they were constantly acting, and I didn't get anything that feels intimate or right to me. Hmm. And that's obviously much easier on the street.
So how many rolls would you shoot of a homeless person before you get an intimate shot?
You never know. And sometimes, you know, some of the pictures are like more than others. But, you know, maybe 30, 40 frames each.
So a lot less than like a Brad Pitt, for example.
About the same. No, about the same, because Brad Pitt would have a lot less time. You know, so on average, I would spend like 15 minutes with each of them. Some, you know, start talking and they keep on talking, they keep on talking, they keep on talking. And it can be half an hour, and others don't want to say much. So then it only takes maybe 5 or 7 minutes.
There's one photo of a back of a head. Why did you include that one?
I started talking to David, and it turns out that he's a full-time student at a university. And his, the other people don't know that he is homeless. Nobody at the school knows that he's homeless except for one close friend of his. So as the conversation progressed, I was wondering, are you sure you really want to, you know, be featured potentially on National Geographic Instagram? Everybody will know that you're homeless now. And then it dawned on him that it might not be a good idea to reveal his identity. So I took a picture from the back of his head.
Hmm. Did any of your other subjects have those concerns?
No, I asked everybody, and surprisingly enough, two or three people, when they realized what this was about, they said, oh, do you mind if you don't use me? And that's fine. I photographed maybe 150 people, but out of 150 people, maybe three didn't want to be featured.
Hmm.
So they already know by the time they sit down, somebody talks to them, explains it to them, what I'm doing. You know, I have basically like a whole line of people waiting to be photographed, and I have people helping me that talk to them, explain to them, so they have a good idea what this is about and what this is for.
I mean, do you ever wonder or think or try to avoid this, that perhaps you might be glamorizing homelessness or glamorizing their plight?
I don't think there's anything, you know, I think my portraits are just very honest, straightforward, and not heroic. You know, most people always don't like themselves in those pictures. Nobody feels like they're being celebrated. I actually have a little bit more of an issue with famous people not wanting to be photographed by me because they're not glamorizing enough. And I think once you read the stories, they're just oftentimes so heartbreaking that, you know, you don't want to trade shoes with any of these people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's so terrible living on the street.
Yeah. And what have the comments been on your Instagram on these photos?
I tried not to read too many of the comments because a lot of them are very complimentary, which is great, and which is, very nice. And I have actually read to some of my, you know, when I go back to the street corner and I see some of the people I photographed that are already posted, then I would, you know, say, hey, do you have Instagram? Did you see this? And read some of the comments out to them. You know, it's interesting. You know, it's kind of what I expected. Some people are very hateful towards homeless people. They feel it's their own fault. They feel they deserve to be living on the street. If you're a drug addict, you don't deserve any better. There's very little understanding for how people end up in these situations. And others are very, very sympathetic to my cause. I think it's important as a photographer, if you're doing well, or as general, if you're doing well, to think about how you can give back to a society that has given you so much.
Well, Martin Schuller, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was photographer Martin Schuller. You can find his homeless portraits on his Instagram account. He's on there under his full name, spelled Martin, M-A-R-T-I-N, Schuller, S-C-H-O-E-L-L-E-R, all one word. We also have a bunch of his photos on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Hello, Harriet Tubman. Goodbye, Andrew Jackson. That's next on Press Play.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Harriet Tubman made history earlier this year, again. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew announced that Tubman will replace Andrew Jackson on the $20 bill. It appears that fans of Alexander Hamilton, both the man and the musical, also have something to sing about. Hamilton was going to be replaced on the $10 bill, but apparently faced with opposition from the Broadway show's creator, a recent Pulitzer Prize winner, and furor from his fans, the Treasury reversed course. Hamilton is here to stay. Our regular contributor, Mike Schlitt, is an amateur historian and a fan of Hamilton, the man and the musical, and he's here now. Hi.
Hello, Madeline.
Are you going to sing a few bars?
I will spare you and your listeners that. I will say that before I got a call, I was in fact sitting in my car singing along to the Broadway soundtrack album.
Yes, which yes. You have, but you haven't seen the musical yet.
No, and if you know anybody...
Who, yeah.
Let's talk.
Okay,
let's talk.
We'll talk off.
I'll be in
mic.
New York in August.
All right, so... Alexander Hamilton, he is involved in our monetary system, so this is an appropriate conversation. Tell us more.
First of all, as the musical accurately frames it, he's one of the nation's great immigrant success stories. He was born into poverty in the West Indies, and he became a protege of George Washington. He was chief of staff in the Revolutionary War. He was one of the authors of the Federalist Papers, and mostly germane to this conversation, he was the founder of the nation's financial system and our first Secretary of Treasury. So it seems very fitting that you would have and keep a man like Alexander Hamilton on a $10 bill, or any dollar bill for
right.
that matter.
So why would Jack Lew want to kick him off if he's actually one of his forebears?
I certainly cannot read Mr. Lew's mind, perhaps because he was never an actual president of the United States. Perhaps, I know where you may be going with this, he was a notorious philanderer.
How did you know I was going there?
I don't know. I just know the way your mind works, I guess. Yeah, and actually, unlike many philanderers in our nation's history, Thomas Jefferson would be one, Franklin Roosevelt, Eisenhower, John F. Kennedy, even Bill Clinton. Hamilton's political career was destroyed by the revelation of his one particular affair.
Oh.
He basically took up with a woman, and her husband either knew about it from the beginning, a guy named James Reynolds, or he found out about it quickly and started blackmailing Hamilton. And, you know, Hamilton was a bit of a spark plug, a lightning rod, if you will. And there were a lot of people who did not like him in government, Thomas Jefferson being one of them. But they couldn't touch him because he was protected by Washington, who was, you know, a larger than life figure. Mm. So when Washington stepped away from the political stage, from the public space, the enemies started coming out. And they had collected some dirt. See, nothing changes really when you
yeah,
think about it.
Interesting.
They had collected some dirt. They found out about these repeated payments to his mistress's husband. Assumed that it was, shall we say, malfeasance of federal funds. It was not. He had, you know, Hamilton was very methodical about his bribery payments and could prove that it had nothing to do, that he was not taking Treasury funds and absconding with them. But he decided, interestingly, to stop the rumors from destroying him. He went public and you know, it's regardless of what his intention was, it still ended up ending his political career, or certainly putting the period at the end of the sentence of his political career.
I think a lot of us know Hamilton from the famous duel he had with Aaron Burr.
And there's been a lot of there's sort of some blowback on the play that it doesn't really touch on what the issues of the or what actually sparked the duel.
What was the origin of the duel?
Hamilton and Burr had known each other for a long time. The play, the way the play presents it, and which is true, is that there was a tie in the presidential election between Jefferson and Burr. And essentially, Hamilton's support of Jefferson was what made him ended up making Jefferson the winner of that election, which I'm sure Burr did not take well. And, you know, it was sort of like the straw that broke the camel's back. And so Burr challenged him to a duel, and they fought in Weehawken, interestingly enough, in the same spot where Hamilton's son had been killed in a duel a few years earlier. Mm. And like his son, Hamilton
perished.
Yeah.
Do you think anyone would have cared about him, whether or not he was on the money or not, if it wasn't for this musical?
I really believe that the success of the musical has definitely changed the zeitgeist view of Hamilton in our nation's history. Absolutely.
Okay. Let's talk about Andrew Jackson. He's not as fortunate.
Yeah.
He's leaving.
First of all, I want to say poor Andrew Jackson, because it wasn't too long ago that he got a facelift on the $20 bill and they made him younger and leaner and far more dashing.
Yeah.
So he barely had a few years to enjoy his new visage. Anyway, it is, I think, very fitting that this is the choice they made. And I wouldn't say up in arms about when they were talking about keeping Jackson and removing Hamilton. But I mean, Hamilton was the guy that founded our financial system. And Jackson is a guy who hated paper money. The entire second term of his presidency was about vetoing the charter of the Second National Bank. So to have a guy who distrusted paper money, who, I mean, interestingly enough, since banks being too big and too powerful and unaccountable to the population is in the national dialogue today, and it was very much in the national dialogue in Jackson's time. But the entire defining issue of his second term in office was destroying the national bank. So for a guy who hated paper money to be on a piece of paper money seems to me a disturbing lack of awareness of our nation's history, and very, very inappropriate. I think Jackson would be thrilled to be removed from the $20 bill.
Really?
Quite honestly, yes.
And Harriet Tubman will be on it, will replace him.
Yes.
Famous abolitionist.
I think it was a good choice. Harriet Tubman is another classic heroic American story. She was born into slavery. She married into freedom. She and became a symbol of resistance and bravery and a conductor in the Underground Railroad. Then she became a Civil War hero. She was a great proponent of education after the Civil War, even though she couldn't read or write. And she was also a suffragette, a friend of Susan B. Anthony. It's a bit of a sly, symbolic act on Jack Lew's part, because he's sort of killing two birds with one stone, right? He's creating a symbol on our bill which addresses two shameful legacies in our nation's history. One, slavery and the legacy of racial injustice, and two, the fact that women, although were not deemed property by the Supreme Court, they were not granted rights of citizenship or the right to vote until the 19th Amendment was passed in 1920. So, and I know there was some talk about Susan B. Anthony. I can see why they chose Harriet Tubman over Susan B. Anthony, and I think it's a good choice. Although those legacies still exist, and I would suggest that we think about using those $20 bills to actually maybe think about paying off some reparations to African Americans and maybe creating equal wages for women.
Or you could just make the $20 bill worth $15, because that's what it would be worth.
Let's call
given the three quarters.
That's right.
Wages that women make for every dollar.
Now that you mention it, good point.
Okay, well, that was fun to jaw about, but the truth is the new designs for our money will not be made public until 2020, and it may be another decade before they actually get printed.
Really?
Really. Mike Schillett is an amateur historian and regular contributor to Press Play. You can follow his travels along the presidential campaign trail at MikeSchillett.com. Sing a little.
How does a bastard orphan son of a whore and a Scotsman grow up to be dropped in the middle of the Caribbean?
Spot in the Caribbean by providence, impoverished and squalor. Grow up to be a hero and a scholar.
The $10.
And that's it for a Memorial Day edition of Press Play. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.